big rocks and all that sort of thing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of the Mick Wall podcast. It's actually a joint effort today. I've joined forces with my young friend in Dublin, Fergal Trainer, of the famous That Fecking Metal podcast. So it's the Mick Wall podcast, but it's simultaneously That Fecking Metal podcast. And Fergal's going to tell you why we're doing this.
Yes. So we've been trying to put this together for a while. There were various cancellations on, I think, both of our parts. More recently, mine.
Just you, Fergal. I was always ready to go.
Yes. So there will be a mixture of fact and fiction in this podcast. So this is to discuss one of the most celebrated Irish rock musicians that's ever lived and unfortunately died almost 37 years ago. That's going to play a part in this episode and our discussion as well. And that is, of course, Phil. And I used to always pronounce his name as Linnet, as does everybody who lives in Ireland. And I used to notice that you, Mick, always pronounced it as Linnet. And it used to kind of wind me up because I thought you were wrong. And it used to get under my skin.
Yes, but you know, Fergal, as you know, I'm never wrong.
Well,
Actually, hang on.
Yeah, go on.
I will mention that I was recently watching the documentary Songs for While I'm Away, which features his daughters, Kathleen and Sarah. The viewers of that documentary learned that it's actually pronounced Linnet, and that he always hated when people referred to him as Linnet, and it's very much pronounced Linnet. So that was something new for me. I don't know how comfortable I am saying that, having led an entire life of saying it the other way, the wrong way, but which everyone uses in Ireland that I've ever known. But I used to see people in documentaries or hear people on podcasts like you, maybe American people as well, and they'd always say Linnet, and I'd be like, no. But it turns out that that's actually wrong. Or sorry, that's actually right.
You know, yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, because I used to, not, I don't about get wound up, but I always used to jar at me whenever I heard people call him Phil. Because when I met him, he once said to me, my friends call me Philip.
Okay.
And having said that, I never heard any of his friends ever call him Philip. Apart from Eric Bell, maybe. I was going to say Brian Downey, but I don't think Brian did either. Definitely not Scott Gorham, and definitely not Robbo. So my friends call me Philip, but I barely remember anybody calling him Philip other than maybe once in my whole life. Okay. It's a bit like with David Bowie, who I was a huge fan of as a younger guy, teenager, and I always called him Bowie.
Yeah.
And I hated it when people called him Bowie. I just thought, it's Bowie. And then sometime in my 20s or 30s, reading about his story, you know, and they say, oh, he took the name of the Bowie knife.
Yeah.
And then I actually met him and asked him, and he said Bowie. So now I've got the reverse. You know, Ricky Gervais, who's a huge Bowie fan, always says Bowie.
Yeah, I've noticed.
And I could slap him for doing that, you know. I understand. But it's weird, isn't it? It gets on your tits.
Yeah. But then I find, actually, maybe you don't, this doesn't bother you as much, but I find when I'm pronouncing people's names on a podcast, I can get quite self-conscious then thinking about whether or not I'm pronouncing it correctly. And I'll often look it up and there'll be mixed results. Like, it's, people are like certain it's this way and they're certain it's that way. So I just kind of lead into it and go, I don't know which way it is, but I'm just going to say it like this.
Yeah, I think of that scene in Pulp Fiction where the Bruce Willis character has just knocked that guy out in the ring and he's now on the run and he lands on this taxi driven by this South American taxi driver woman.
Yeah.
And they're talking and she's like, Bush. Because his name's Butch.
Yeah.
Bush. Bush. And she starts talking about names. And he said, this is America, baby. Names don't mean shit. And I think that's quite a good metaphor for the modern world. You can be whoever you want. Change your name. Anyway. So, Phil, Philip, Linnet, Linnet. Why don't we start with you explaining what Thin Lizzy, how you, your first experience of Thin Lizzy, because over here in England, it's we all would share, of a certain age, we would share how we first got to know of him and Thin Lizzy. But
sure.
What about a younger guy like yourself in Dublin?
True, like many bands, I first was exposed to Thin Lizzy through a compilation album that my brother had called Wild One. And I remember there was a UK television show called Gladiators. I'm sure you remember it. And
oh, yeah, the wrestlers.
Well, it was more Gladiators. Like the public would compete against these people in various feats of strength and activities, whatever. And one song that they always played in that when the Gladiators ran out was The Boys Are Back in Town. And I didn't know who this was by or what it was. I was 8 years old. But my brother was playing a CD one time and he was playing the full song of The Boys Are Back in Town. And I was like, whoa, 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 that's the song from Gladiators. And he's like, no, this is Thin Lizzy. And I was like, right, okay. So I remember playing that CD and like copying it onto a cassette when I was younger. And there were songs that jumped out at you, like Emerald, Cowboy Song, and The Boys Are Back in Town. And then Whiskey in the Jar, which I was familiar with as well. So you couldn't avoid that song growing up in Dublin. Again, I wouldn't have known who was doing that particular rendition of it, but that's certainly the one I was familiar with all of the kind of guitar riffing and stuff at the start. So yeah, from an early age, I would have known who they were. It wasn't until I got into rock music kind of on my own terms that I properly started investigating the band and buying their albums and stuff. And I noticed then that my brother also had Live and Dangerous.
Oh, now you're talking.
And I never went beyond the greatest hits in the early days with bands. I just kind of pick up my brother's CD, listen to it and go, oh, deadly, yeah, that's Thin Lizzy. But I started listening to Live and Dangerous. And then there was a compilation album out in like 2004 called Thin Lizzy Greatest Hits, but it was a double CD. And my friends and I all bought that. And it had like a career retrospective, and it featured songs from like towards the end of their career as well, like Renegade and Thunder and Lightning and Cold Sweat. And I found I really enjoyed those songs. So when I went and investigated Thin Lizzy, I went out and bought albums like Renegade, Thunder and Lightning, and then worked my way back kind of, which I kind of tended to do sometimes with bands, because I'd be like, I want the stuff that's less known and more recent, and then I'll go back to the classics after that. So that's kind of a synopsis of my journey with Thin Lizzy.
Well, for me, it was Whiskey in the Jar, which was a song I was already familiar with because my father, who used to play Irish and Scottish folk music in various pubs and clubs, him and his ragtaggle band would play it, but they'd do like the Dubliners version, you know. And I was going over, you know.
Yeah.
So to hear it done in that kind of rock style was really interesting. And I remember I bought the single when it was in the charts. So we're talking early 73. And but I was very intrigued by the B-side, which was Black Boys on the Corner.
Oh, yeah.
And so Whiskey in the Jar was what it was. It was kind of like a novelty record.
Mm.
But the B-side was an original, and it was very kind of Hendrix-y and rock, heavy rock.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I really liked it. So I started paying attention. And in those days, they were very popular on Radio Luxembourg, which was the kind of where you know, Luxembourg was like Radio 1, but they played more album tracks.
Yeah.
And their top 40 was very similar, but a little bit hipper.
Okay.
They'd have American records in there.
It always comes up, Radio Luxembourg, when people are talking about their early music influences and stuff like that, or where they first heard X band or whatever. It always tends to come up.
Well, because Radio 1 was very BBC, still is, but was even more BBC in those days. You know, you'd have Engelbert Humperdinck played next to Gary Glitter, played next to David Bowie. Luxembourg wasn't like that.
Hmm.
They just played good stuff. And one of their DJs was Kid Jensen, who we now know as David Jensen,
okay,
who did end up on Radio 1, and he's still out there.
Yeah.
But he was big on Thin Lizzy. And there was a follow-up to Whiskey in the Jar, which was a big flop, Rudolph's Tango or something, Randolph's Tango. But he would always play that. It was kind of like a Rod Stewart, You Wear It Well type thing. Big flop. And then the next album, I can't remember, was it Vagabonds of the Western World?
Or yeah.
The one, I don't
know. That was the final one with the original lineup.
Right, and they, I look back now and I realise it would have been decided beforehand, but I didn't know that as a kid. But Kid Jensen had Lina and Robbo on the show, and of course it was raucous.
Mm.
But they did this thing where you could vote for which track should be the next single. And they played The Rocker and a couple of others. And it was like, The Rocker, that's the one, The Rocker. And it came out, that's the one that everybody's voted for, you know.
Yeah.
So it did become the next single, and it was a great track, but again, not a hit. But around that time, my dad, because he had a younger guy, younger Irish guy suddenly in his group, who was really into Rod Stewart. So my dad got into Rod Stewart. That was weird. But then this younger guy also got into Thin Lizzy and Horselips. Remember Horselips? Oh, yeah. And my dad really liked Horselips because there was a lot of more traditional Irish music in that. And the next thing, Thin Lizzy, because Vagabonds, well, all of Thin Lizzy in those days had that Irish, huge Irish influence.
Mm.
So there was all that going on. And Kid Jensen actually had a spoken word part on Vagabonds. And so very much on the periphery was this group Thin Lizzy that you never knew if they were going to make it. Probably not. But I was always kind of had my antenna attuned. And then in the summer of 76, which happened to be the first summer I lived away from home, the boys are back in town. And I lived in this big hippie house. It had formerly been a guest house, a B&B, so it was quite big. And we're all sitting on the floor in this huge lounge watching this tiny old telly. And it's Top of the Pops, and it's Thin Lizzy, the boys are back in town. And they weren't in the studio, it was a clip. And the whole room went wild, like, this is the fucking real deal, you know? Yeah. And I agreed. So I went out and got the Jailbreak album, and I just loved it. And then in October, November that same year, 76, they put out Johnny the Fox. They would put out records like within 6 months of each other.
Yeah.
And they had Don't Believe a Word on that, which was another great track, a hit single, Top of the Pops, blah, blah, blah. And then out of the blue, a guy I knew, I didn't know him hugely well, but he'd come round the house. In those days, no social media. People just would knock on the door. Oh, I know Bob. Oh, you better come in then.
Horrifying to think of now.
Yeah, and they'd stay for 5 days, you know, 6 months or something. Yeah, man, come on in, you know. It always, strangers wandering around the whole time.
Mm.
And one of these guys, Pete, who I did get to know a bit, he was writing for Sounds magazine, Pete Makovsky.
Yep.
And I remember thinking, God, what a terrible job that must be. Can you imagine going to a show and enjoying yourself and then having to come home and write about it, like homework, you know? I just thought, poor guy, you know? I mean, because I had stopped reading them by then. And he said, look, I've got a spare ticket to see Thin Lizzy at the Hammersmith Odeon. Do you want to come? I went, yeah. I'd never seen them before. And we were in the balcony, and I just remember they came on. They had the police lights and this siren, and then suddenly the opening chords to Jailbreak. Fucking brilliant. Hell, man. I mean, yeah. I was out of my seat like this.
Yeah.
So was everybody, except next to me, Pete, who still sat in his chair, because he's seen a million shows at this point, plus he's seen Thin Lizzy a million times. And
it's a busman's holiday for him.
Yeah, and I couldn't understand it. What's wrong with Pete? He's not well, you know. Mm. Anyway, fantastic show. And we're leaving, and I'm kind of like, well, you know, how do we get home? And he said, he's talked like that, Pete, and he goes, now I'm going to go to the party. I went, oh, what party? Yeah, for the band. For the band? And he got us a ride, some fabulous sort of people. I mean, I was 18. He was maybe 20. And the fabulous people were all in their 20s, so sort of older to me.
Mm.
And they all knew each other, and they all kind of knew the deal. I knew nothing. And we go to this party, and it is a full-on rock and roll party. George Best is there.
Jesus.
Alex Higgins.
Right.
All
the best drinkers.
A lot of Page Three girls from The Sun. And Pete, I'm in Pete's shadow just following, you know. And he goes straight over to Lina. What, Phil? She was like, ah, fuck off, Pete. You know. And this is Mick. Hello, Mick. You know, I was like, oh, Phil. Yeah.
Did you say my friends call me Michael?
I should have done. Except A, I had no friends. And B, no one called me Michael, uh-huh, except my mum and dad. But next thing, this creature, it literally was a creature, sort of hunchback creature, very unpleasant looking, with very strange orange hair sticking out and short and horrible guy. And he comes going, all right, Phil. He was like, ah, fuck off, Johnny, now. And he's like, I fucking hate these parties. They're so boring. I'm thinking, who is this horrible cunt, you know? Anyway, so they have a bit of a laugh, and Phil goes, ah, fuck off, Johnny. Pushes him away. And Pete is finished talking to Phil, so we go over to the bar. And I said to Pete, who is that awful bloke? And he goes, oh, Johnny Rotten. I went, what? He goes, Johnny Rotten. I went, oh, fuck off. That's not his name. He goes, yeah. I'm thinking, Johnny Rotten? It's just, I'd never heard it, you know. Of course, you know who that was.
Yes.
I
think he does ads for, I can't believe it's not butter or something recently, is it?
Well, these days he's a Trump supporting monarchist, you know, so
which the most unlikely turn of events in the world, but anyway.
Yeah, he's also fat as fuck, you know.
I saw terrible. That. Was he not ill though? I think he was ill.
No, it's his wife, Nora.
Oh, right, okay.
She's very ill. I think it's like dementia and
okay.
And I don't know why that would necessarily make him fat, other than I think he just spends all day drinking beer and smoking fags and looking after Nora.
Hmm.
Anyway, I thought, blimey, this writing for the music paper stuff, you know, it might have its benefits, you know. So in a very long roundabout way, that was what first gave me the thought of maybe I could do that.
Hmm.
Because I'd always been okay at writing. In fact, it was the only thing I was good at school.
Some might say you still are. Okay, right.
And so literally almost a year later, I had my very first review published in Sounds. Bukowski had nothing to do with it. I didn't tell him. I kept it all secret because if I did get published, I wanted it to be because I had written something worth publishing.
Yeah, fair enough.
But that was a start for me. But then cut. Get to 1979, and I'm working as a very junior member of a publicity company called Heavy Publicity. And that was where I started to get to know Thin Lizzy. Thin Lizzy weren't one of their clients, but Wild Horses were one of their clients. And that was the band Brian Robertson formed with Jimmy Bain. Robbo had just been kicked out of Lizzy for the second time, and Jimmy had just been fired from Rainbow.
Mm.
But here was what was odd for me was what I discovered writing for Sounds was that you almost never met anybody that you once bought a record by. You were always sent to write about Egypts you'd never heard of,
yeah,
and that you'd never hear of again, you know, because I was on the lowest rung. So unusually for me, through working with Wild Horses, Lynott and all the guys would always come to their shows. And they would always go to their shows, and I'd be amongst that gang that went. And that was very strange, because you mentioned Live and Dangerous.
Yeah.
That, for me, is their best album. Because when I listen back to their records from that period now, to me, they sound dreadful. They sound so thin and weedy. The production is shite, you know. Mm. But Live and Dangerous, it was that Toontown moment where you go through the tunnel in black and white, you come out and it's all colour and cartoons. And so I was seriously grooving to that. And then just after that, while that's still going on, I meet the band and I'm one of the guys working with the bands. Wild Horses toured with Thin Lizzy. And that was quite weird, getting to know Phil, but still going home at night and playing Live and Dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah. You hear a lot of words used to describe Phil, like he was a poet, people often say about his lyrics. He could be very charming, but like he could be gregarious yet shy. How did you find him in person? Did he have those elements you often hear about rock stars where he's outgoing yet introverted at the same time? Because that's the kind of picture I've drawn up in my head from various things people have said over the years about him.
He definitely had a sensitive side, and he was a poet and he did write that stuff. By the time I got to know him, you know, he was in his full bloom, and the drugs were everywhere. Not just for them, but for all the bands back then. But yeah. Kind of especially him, because he was the man. You know, when he walked in the room, all eyes went on him.
Mm.
And he was very charismatic. But he was very quietly spoken. But he was very, very quick-witted. Yeah. You know, I always tell a story of being with him. Not long before he died, a few months before he died, he was doing a telly thing and I was the presenter, and we were happened to be in the tiny little makeup room together. And we're sat there with our bibs on. You've got to make small talk. And for some fucking reason, I've no idea why I said this, because I look back and I cringe. But I said to him, you know, do you ever regret it that you didn't make it in America? You know, because they should have done. And I hate doing the accent in front of you because it makes me such a fucking idiot. But it's hard to tell without trying to imitate how he would deliver it. But he said, oh, yeah, you know. He goes, but it's a bit like regretting you didn't fuck Kate Bush. You know, it's of course it's a regret, but yeah. What are you going to do, you know? Mm. So he was very witty. But he was a hard man, you know, Lizzie and Wild Horses shared a lot of the same roadies and crews, and there was one guy, Big Charlie, who's now dead. He was, you know, one of the big figures in the Lizzie Road crew, and again for Horses when Lizzie weren't working. And I remember him saying to me his audition for the job when he sat down with Phil, because Phil was the hirer and the firer. No one else was involved. He really was the leader.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, oh, you know, well, I probably asked him what other bands he'd worked with, but you know, how are you on the lights or whatever it is? He just said, can you fight?
Yeah.
And Big Charlie said, yeah, you got the job.
Yeah.
You know, you got to know how to fight to work for Thin Lizzy. And in fairness, what people that weren't around in those days need to be reminded of is that, you know, there was no production. There were no mobile phones. You could be in the middle of... Most shows would take place in a place called the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Every now and again, you'd hit London or Dublin or Manchester. Mm. Or New York, or wherever it might be. But 99% of the shows are in places you are in the middle of fucking nowhere. And quite often you would come across trouble, and you, if you couldn't handle it, you were dead. So that fighting thing was a regular occurrence. I mean, when I worked with Wild Horses, they did a show at the Porterhouse in Retford, which is a tiny, shitty club in the Midlands. We used to call it the Slaughterhouse, Retford, because it was just always trouble. But I remember the band were on stage, and this guy in the audience, drunk, was, you know, heckling, and he kind of went to charge the stage, and Robbo literally mid-solo just took his guitar off, swung it, battered this guy straight across the head.
Mm.
Guy goes flying. Robbo back on with the guitar. Diddly, 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 diddly.
Yeah.
They could see the guy's mates going, yeah, and Robbo's going, yeah, fucking... I mean, that's what it was like. Yeah.
Yeah. I often wonder when I hear these stories, like, did people just go to shows then? I'm sidetracking a small bit, but did it just go to shows to cause trouble? Like, or were they being a Thin Lizzy fan and they got too drunk and then they were like, fuck it, I'm going to heckle? Or what was it like? Both.
Both, because tickets were cheap in those days.
Mm.
So, I mean, I used to do it myself. You'd go to a venue for your night out. You know, like these days, Friday night comes, should we go to that pub that we always go to? Or what will we do, you know? Places like the Slaughterhouse, the Porterhouse, Retford. There was JB's in Dudley. We used to call it Junkies in Dudley. Mm. And it was 50p to get in, you know, or a quid. Quid if you were big. 75p, you know.
Yeah.
Because bands made no money touring. The touring was purely to help sell the records, and the records were what made the money. These days, of course, it's the complete opposite. The opposite,
yeah. So not only, like, is 75p, it's also relatively cheaper back in 1977, as in, like, it represents a much smaller fraction of your wage, basically, so...
Oh, it's tiny. It's tiny. Yeah. I mean, you know, price of a pint, you know, 2 pints maybe.
Hmm.
Pint and a packet of fags. So you would, in the club, obviously if you're buying a ticket for a concert, that's different. You're all going there because it's a concert.
Yeah.
But to get into some club in the middle of nowhere, that's just where they went on a Tuesday night or whatever it was.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, well, a friend of mine, Ian Jeffrey, he was the tour manager for AC/DC around exactly this time, 76, 77. And he's and these days he does U2 and Lady Gaga, right? And he said, these days you literally push a button on a laptop and you go and have dinner while the band do their thing. He said, in the 70s, he said, every single night was going to war because there were no productions. You just had to play. And people were used to seeing lots of bands all the time on that circuit because, like I say, it was cheap and accessible.
Yeah.
And, you had to win them over. You know, by the time you get to, you know, the big shows, people in the audience are your fans. At these shows, you're playing to maybe a few fans, but mainly you're playing to people that are waiting to be entertained or impressed.
Yeah, I get you,
yeah, we had fucking Horselips in here last week, mate. You're nothing. We had Rory Gallagher. That's a fucking musician. What are you, load of fucking poofs, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, it was going to war every night.
And did you ever see Phil himself have to go to war? Or are there any stories that you have about that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. At the, what do you call it? You know, like the playback of the Black Rose album.
Mm.
And then there's the reception, which is the party. So everybody sits there dutifully listening to the record, you know, which in those days, mercifully, was about 35 minutes, you know, for an album. These days, someone goes, come to a playback, you're like, oh, fucking hell, there goes an hour and a half, you know.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. And you'd have drinks with you and fag, you'd be listening and chatting, you know, and half an hour later, you're in the bar. So now one of the things Phil... one of his habits, he loved Ireland, but he understood, he knew the history. He used to read all about it. Scott Gorham said to me once, he goes, we'd be in Ireland and Phil would get us up early in the morning to go and visit some well, you know, and he'd be, well, you see, boys, here in 1503, your man Fergal fought the battle of the two dead English guys who deserved to die. And Scott would be going, oh, for fuck's sake, man.
Yeah.
You know. So Phil was very proud of what he called my people.
Hmm.
Now, there was a Melody Maker journalist in those days called Alan Jones, who was a Welshman. And he's still around. He ended up being the big editor on Uncut magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Great writer.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Really good writer, but you know, like most Celts, he loved a drink, and he was just famous for getting in rock stars' faces. You know, there's a famous photo of Alan completely pissed talking to Lou Reed in the 70s. And Lou Reed's, you know, like, I'm Lou Reed and you're all scum. And Jones is in his face going, oh, fuck, go on, Jonesy, go on, you know. Yeah. So Phil's at the bar waxing lyrical about my people. And this is a quote, okay? So I know these days people get very nervous around this sort of language, but this is 1979. And Phil's, my people. And Jonesy, pissed, goes up and he goes, which people are they, Phil? The Paddies or the niggers?
Yep.
And Phil literally turned round and smacked him straight in the face. And Phil had hands like shovels, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Smacked him. And Jonesy, like in a cowboy movie, he just went boom, 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 all the way down the bar. Flat out. Meanwhile, the Lizzie Roadies are fucking coming over now. And they pick him up. They literally one.
Yeah.
Two. Out the door.
Right.
But Phil at the bar, here's another thing he used to do. All the time. Because he would always... He couldn't stay home at night. He would always go to gigs, pubs, no security.
Hmm.
Just Phil. I, of course, everywhere he went, he had friends, you know, that would look out for him. And On this particular occasion, I was that friend, unwittingly. So we go into this pub in Hammersmith, and it's fairly empty. It's early. And we go to the bar, and we get the drinks. And he says to me, do me a favour. Go and grab a table. I'll be over in a minute. I went, okay. He said, give me a moment. Go and grab a table. I went, okay. So I go and sit at this table in this fairly empty pub, and he stood at the bar. It's hard to show you on a screen, but he stood at the bar. He's kind of like this with his head down, you know, like, you know, sad.
Yeah.
You know. And I swear to God, Fergal, first one, then another, a girl comes up on this side, and then a girl comes up on this side, and they're going, are you all right, Phil? Oh, well, darling, you know, yeah, it's tough at the top, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, Phil, you know, Phil. Ah, well, you know. And so after about 5 minutes of this, he brings them both back to the table where I'm sitting, like the booby prize, you know. Please, God, let me get Phil, not the other bloke. Yeah. Being Phil... neither one of them got me, but they both got Phil.
Yeah.
And I swear to God, Fergal, after about 20, you know, we're all having a drink and a chat, and the next thing, him and one of these girls have gone to the toilet. One's gone, and then one's gone, and they're gone for about 20 minutes. And then they come back in. He's taken her out the back, hasn't he, and shagged her. And they come back in, and it's so obvious, but she's like all lit up, and he's, you know, he's looking for another drink. So another 20 minutes, and he disappears with the other girl out the back, and eventually comes back.
Some man.
And I'm thinking, is it my turn yet?
did you ever try that head down on the bar move yourself?
Oh, many times, but you know, people just, in my case, people just sort of drift away. They go, oh, fucking hell, look at the weird guy. Don't go near that guy. He looks like a fucking, you know, terrorist. So he really had the patter, but he was very much a kind of a man's man. I mean, the big love of his life before he got to England, and then during those early years in England, was a lady called Gail Claydon, who actually came from Northern Ireland, but ended up in Dublin in the late 60s, early 70s. And then by the mid 80s, she's a TV producer producing the Monsters of Rock show on Sky, yeah, which is how I met her. And anyway, she was telling me not so long ago, I was doing a thing on Phil for a magazine, and I rang her. She's retired now. And she was saying, I asked her how she met him. She said it was her birthday party at this place in Dublin. You know, she was a young woman sharing a house with other friends,
yeah,
or students or whatever. Big party, the whole house rammed with crazy stuff. And she went to bed. Eventually the party's over, it's 4 a.m. or something. She goes to bed, she goes, next thing there's a little gentle knock on the door, and Phil comes in, and he sits on the bed, and she said he was the most gentle, charming, amazing guy, and he just completely won her heart. She goes, it was only later I found out he'd already screwed two other girls that night at the party. So that's who he was. But he also wrote poetry. He wrote great songs. For me, that's losing a life, obviously, is the ultimate price to pay. But long before Phil died, I think his talent really suffered because of the drugs, specifically heroin.
Yeah.
Because he didn't write anymore, you know. He didn't write stories or poems. He didn't write for pleasure. He didn't get inspired and write. And you know, you mentioned Renegade. You know, I always felt that was a very sort of disappointing album in the context of what he'd achieved before.
Mm.
Thunder and Lightning was like the unforeseen, amazing comeback. He'd against all odds, it seemed at the time.
Yeah,
he'd made a great Thin Lizzy album, one of the very best in my view, when he had John Sykes in the band.
There's some beautiful lyrics on the song Renegade, though. I'm just going to read out a few of them here. And it seems to be very autobiographical at this point. He's like, he's just a boy that has lost his way. He's a rebel that has fallen down. He's a fool that's blown away. To you and me, he's a renegade. He's a clown that we put down. He's a man that doesn't fit. He's a king, but not in this town. To you and me, he's a renegade.
Wow.
It's like the juxtaposition of his confidence and insecurity right there.
He wrote a lot of very kind of elegiac, that's how you say it, songs in the last few years of his life, or his career with Lizzy, certainly. Songs about small towns and, you know, boys that are lost. I mean, even like as far back as Black Rose, Gotta Give It Up, you know.
Yeah.
Mama, you, your son has gone down the whiskey. Or I can't remember the words, but, you know, there was a lot of your boy, your wonderful boy has got lost in this terrible world. He wrote a lot of those.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting point you raised. So maybe he was still good.
A friend of mine, Jonathan, I told him I was going to be chatting to you today. He's a big Thin Lizzy fan. And he mentioned that he felt Phil Lynott had a very good way of presenting both sides of the story in a song. And that's a good example there. He's like a clown and a renegade, you know, a rebel, but a figure that's, you know, to be pitied at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get it. I mean, Phil's cunning plan was to do a Rod Stewart, you know. By 1980, I think he'd correctly surmised that Lizzy were as big as they were ever gonna be. They really had blown their chance in America.
Yeah.
These days, of course, we realize that these things can come full circle, but back then, no one thought we'd still be talking about this 40 years later. You know, it was yeah, either now or never.
Yeah.
So he, you know, was solo in Soho and the follow-up. I can't remember the name of the follow-up. The Philip Lynott album. In his mind, that was going to be his transition to being a full-time solo star. He had Midge writing with him. He was trying to do music that wasn't just guitar based, and it didn't quite happen. I feel strongly that I can't help but feel, because I was there. I was in the studio when they were making Solo in Soho, and it was just drugs everywhere. I am not anti-drugs. I am anti-fucking up.
Yeah.
And at that point, there would be 12 people in the room. It was this tiny studio in Soho, yeah. And it was weird. The actual control room where the guy is with the desk, it was Kit Wolven at the time. A couple of chairs behind him. And then there was like in a theatre, there was a tier, like two or three, like giant steps, and people would sort of sit on there. And I remember Paula Yates was there this night. Geldof was there, but no one was paying any attention. Paula Yates is there sitting on the top step, Fergal, in a very short skirt and no knickers.
Okay.
And she's on the top tier, so she's in your eye line. Okay. And Geldof, you know, we've all either been there ourselves or we've had mates and we've seen it going on. He doesn't know what to do, you know, because she's the boss.
Yeah.
But he always wants to be seen as the boss.
Mm.
And in London, he was, you know, people like, you know, something the Irish, and I think the Scots have in common, definitely not the Welsh, but the Irish and the Scots, along with maybe black people, of course, Phil was two of those. In London, they're very kind of venerated. They're kind of, oh, Jesus, you know, don't mess with that guy, you know. So Geldof was always surrounded by acolytes, music press people up his arse, everybody. Because, you know, he's a big mouth. And, yeah, you know, so he took charge of the room until he walked into a room where Phil was.
Mm.
And then he turned into a gibbering, silly boy, Egypt. Yeah. And And Lina actually gave Geldof some heroin once, specifically so that he'd pass out and Phil could fuck Paula in the next room.
Jesus Christ. Well, I'm glad he gave Geldof the heroin and not Paula, so that's a good thing.
So Paula's in there with her legs wide open and no knickers on and the tiniest skirt you've ever seen. And even when you're deliberately not looking, you're suddenly got eyeballs here. You know, you can see. Mm-hmm. And
peripheral vision.
That's right. You develop it. It's Darwinian. In those circumstances, a Darwinian male thing takes over, and suddenly you have eyes like a fly. You know, and you cannot unsee what you are seeing. Without meaning to get too base, you know, they didn't shave in those days either. So you know, right. Oh yeah. Kate Bush. So, Phil's just laughing and laughing and paying no attention because he was, you know, like I say, he had all kinds of women every day and every night. So anyway, I guess back to my point is that I don't see that as conducive to making great art, whether it's music. I mean, obviously, if you're writing, you don't imagine there'd be 12 Egypts in the room and women with no knickers and people drinking and doing drugs because you're writing. But music, Phil Lynott, Thin Lizzy, that music, that was all about the crack, all about breaking rules, all about giving two fingers to the law, you know, all that stuff.
There are a couple of things that you just made me think of there, and you mentioned like a few minutes ago that these things can come full circle now, so I assume you're referring to like a band could have a second go around. Firstly, do you think Phil Lynott's star shone brighter while he was alive or since he's been dead?
Very tricky. I don't know if it's shone brighter because disappointingly for me, I don't think he gets the recognition he deserves.
Right.
On the other hand, the legend does still live on, and here we are talking about a beautiful statue in Dublin and stuff. Yeah. But, you know, there's a statue of Lemmy outside the Rainbow in LA. You know, statues are great. Phil's is more significant because it's proper in the town.
Mm-hmm.
But try and get the man in the street, the woman in the street, to name more than three Thin Lizzy songs. There's The Boys Are Back in Town,
Whiskey in the Jar, and I don't know, Jailbreak.
I don't even know if they'd say Jailbreak. I think they might say Dancing in the Moonlight.
Dancing in the Moonlight, yeah, okay.
But even Sarah, maybe. They were big hits here. But I think, do you know what? I think it boils down to The Boys Are Back in Town, you know?
Yeah.
And they could probably name more Bon Jovi songs, or maybe one more at least.
Well, Bon Jovi have the luxury of having had a far longer career with far more albums, and they had hits 20 years into their career as well, I think, like, or 15 at least.
Right, and that's partly because they by the time they came along, the era was quickly went into CD. Quickly went into one album every 2 years. You know, Slippery When Wet came out in 86. The follow-up wasn't until 1988, New Jersey. Jailbreak comes out April, May, 76. Johnny the Fox comes out October, November, 76.
Yes.
Bad Reputation comes out summer of 77. You know, they were on a treadmill. And those weren't their first albums. Those were what, their 6th, 7th, 8th albums.
Yeah.
So it was a different era because bands weren't expected to last. If you got 2 years was the shelf life. 5 years, well, blimey, you've made it in America, or you really have had a few hits. No one would go 20. I mean, just it wasn't even in your thoughts. I think Because he was a huge star, Fergal, over here. You know, he was a judge on the Miss World competition. You know, he was one of those guys would turn up on the talk shows.
Yeah.
And everybody recognised him. He was always in the tabloids. And there were always kiss and tells, women saying how he'd shagged them and left them and all this, you know. Because that never happens in rock, you know. So he really was a household name in that regard. And I just feel, you know, he was so charming. If you look at the early clips, he's smiling in nearly all of them.
Mm.
You know, I mean, there's in Sarah, the cheapest video ever made, where he's sitting on a stool miming. And at the end, I think a series of girls comes over and he hugs them or something and they disappear. And then right at the end, Scott Gorham comes on. And they sort of hug and kiss, and it's all funny.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great humour and charm to them. They could make fun.
Mm.
By the time you get to Chinatown, and Thunder and Lightning, if you look at the clips of Thunder and Lightning, he looks like a man who's on his last fucking legs. He's doing his best to hold it together. He's overweight. He's pouring with sweat. And although they were great songs, I just feel that you know, he was his own worst enemy. But to finish the point, they clearly could have come back. You know, I mean, look at Thunder. Thunder, who aren't fit to wipe Thin Lizzy's arse, came back a few years ago, and their last couple of albums have all been top five in the UK. Not that that means anything anymore. But, you know, they're working. And I think
it's better than being in the top 95, so it means something.
It means something, yes, in terms of prestige. But think of the festivals. Who wouldn't pay to see Thin Lizzy?
Yeah, that's what I've always thought. But
and in America, I think, too.
It's an alternate timeline where, like, he doesn't die from heroin and alcohol abuse complications. But let's say he had a kick this year. I would envisage that they'd be still a big festival band, even now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they'd be huge. You know,
Sorry,
go on.
No, you go on.
No, I was going to say, you think of Whitesnake or Black Sabbath or Journey or, you know, all these bands that were pre-internet, classic rock bands.
Yeah.
Def Leppard and Motley Crue have just made like $200 million each in America. You know,
they're playing Marley Park in Dublin, which is the biggest ever gig Def Leppard have attempted to play in Dublin, and the first time ever for Motley Crue, which is madness at this stage of their career. But it'll definitely sell a shitload of tickets, if not sell out.
And the thing is, Fergal, most of the people that will go to those shows weren't even alive when Hysteria by Def Leppard came out, or they were children. And that's the last album by Def Leppard anybody fucking knows. I mean, I know they insist on still putting out records, and I applaud, and I love Def Leppard. I really love them, and I love all the people. I've got a lot of history with them. But the only reason they still make records, as Joe will tell you, is because they want to, not because they sell or anybody pays any attention. You know. So this show, the biggest ever, will be to see a band who lasted anything decent in 87.
It's insane. 36 years ago it will be by the time. One final thing. I know you like to keep these things to an hour, and that's been a great discussion, so maybe we could wrap it up here.
He's getting rid of me. He's had enough.
I know you do. Do you think...
Not when I'm talking to you, though, Fergal.
Even though...
Half an hour with you.
Lizzy, very good. Even though Thin Lizzy weren't an active thing at the time, do you think Geldof snubbed them from Live Aid because of the situation you just explained in the studio there? Because it seems to be a glaring omission.
It's horrifying. I mean, someone recently was telling me about a book called Beetle Bone. I don't know if you know it, but I'd never heard of it. So I ordered it, and I've had a bit of a look. It's fiction, but it's about a time when, and this never happened in real life, but apparently it nearly did. John Lennon, in his latter days in New York in the 70s, he couldn't leave America because he was fighting the green card thing. But there came a moment where I think he'd got the green card, or it definitely looked like it was on the cards, and he was planning to come to Ireland, to go out to the west coast, to a certain island off the west coast of Ireland. And it never happened in the end, but the book is about if it had happened. And I found that very, very interesting. And this person said to me, has said to me many times, you should do a book about Phil. And you can use this as your kind of, not template, but an idea how you could do it. And I was thinking, or I have been thinking, a book about, because, you know, he went to Dublin on the day of Live Aid. He couldn't bear to be in London.
He did some telly thing or something.
He turned up. He wasn't invited. He turned up at RTE and whatever the big radio station is, probably RTE
same,
again.
Same.
and was there kind of, was commentating on it with them as their sort of celebrity. But they hadn't invited him. He just turned up because he was a loose end. And that breaks my fucking heart. And I was thinking about doing a book about, you know, that day or that week. But here's the thing, Fergal. It wasn't just Geldof. It was Midge Ure.
Yeah.
You know, Midge Ure.
Who was his mate?
So was Geldof, you know. Midge Ure had been in, what the fuck were they called? Silk. One big number one. These days you'd call him a boy band. Zero credibility and no more hits. And then he ended up in the Rich Kids, which was the band Glenn Matlock formed after being sacked from the Pistols. And they got a lot of press and sold fuck all. And then he joined Ultravox. But there was this period, because Ultravox were managed by Morrison O'Donnell, who managed Lizzie and Wild Horses. So we were involved on the periphery. We did PR for a few things. But Ultravox had become uncool in the wake of punk. And Ultravox had never been remotely big in the first place. They never had a hit.
They
just had a lot of press. So in that transition period in the summer of 79, Gary Moore walks out on Lizzie on tour in America with Journey. And this was their make or fucking break. They'd already cancelled two big tours. Promoters are going, right, this is it. If you fuck this up, you're dead.
Yeah.
And Gary Moore fucked off, left a note on the pillow, you know, the walk of shame. And they brought Midge Ure in.
Yeah.
Which I thought they should have got Robbo. But anyway, they brought Midge Ure in and, you know, that was like a square peg in a round hole, but he did his best. But it really lifted his profile. And then Midge worked with him on Solo in Soho. Yeah. And they wrote Yellow Peril, which turned into Yellow Pearl, the Top of the Pops theme, and some other things as synthesizers. You know, Phil fucking helped that boy. Got management, got him in Thin Lizzy, got him on his solo album. And then the year after the solo album, Vienna becomes a hit. So cut to three or four years later with the first Band-Aid single.
Oh, yeah.
Why wasn't Phil on that? Fucking Midge, who owed him everything.
Yeah.
Geldof, who Lynyrd had, you know, taken under his wing in Dublin and then in London. I mean, okay, there was a thing with Paula, but are you telling me Phil was the only one that ever got his leg over with Paula Yates while she was with miserable Geldof, you know?
It just seems like the timing would have been perfect for them to do a 3 or 4 song set like Led Zeppelin did or whoever, and Black Sabbath did. And then maybe that would have pushed them in the right direction instead of pushing them off a cliff.
It would have been perfect, Fergal. Black Sabbath, the original lineup, they didn't exist. That wasn't an ongoing thing. Just did it for Live Aid.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin just did it for Live Aid. Status Quo, people go on about Quo. What no one ever hits on is they'd broken up 18 months before. They'd done their farewell tour. But back for Live Aid. So there was absolutely no reason why Thin Lizzy wouldn't have brought the house down. Boys are back in town. And anything else they wanted to play, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I really love things like Warrior. and
Massacre. Fantastic song as well.
Down from the glen came the marching men. You know, I need to tell you what glen.
Wait, no, that's Emerald, is it not?
Oh, sorry, it is.
Massacre is at a point below zero.
Sorry, yeah, absolutely. Did you see that? There was a great clip of them doing it. Oh, I'm getting confused here with Robbo. I posted it after the Bataclan catastrophe.
Possibly.
Yeah. But no, you're right. You're right. And that was Emerald. Yeah. Yeah. Not like me to make a mistake. I blame you entirely.
Never. It's probably because I've kept you on here too long.
No. Well, that's what it is. No, but seriously, to me, the only I can offer you no concrete proof other than some things you just know.
Yeah.
The only reason Thin Lizzy, who would have bitten Geldof's fucking arm off, didn't do Live Aid or Band Aid, which was unforgivable. His fucking Bananarama, where's Phil?
Yeah.
Was because Geldof, Midgeor, I don't think he had any say, but Geldof didn't want him there.
Mm.
Admittedly, he was, you know, he was fucking high maintenance. You know, he never stopped with the heroin. There was no period where...
Can he have been any more high maintenance than Ozzy Osbourne, though, in fairness?
Well, but Ozzy was in America. Sharon, you can rely on her to fucking sort it out. Plus, he wasn't Geldof's mate. He wouldn't be... I think there were many reasons. He wanted to be the most famous Irishman that day, apart from your man Bono, obviously. Mm. But I think at that point, even Geldof was more... famous and sought after them, but
yeah, well, they were only on the ascent then, like they hadn't had their enormous Joshua Tree success.
Geldof would have been more famous. In fact, that gig helped push them to the next level. No, I agree. I mean, Gorham has told me many times how he went after the Farewell Thunder and Lightning tour ends in 83. He goes back to America, gets clean and sober. Because Brian Downey was never into any of that stuff. John Sykes had left for Whitesnake, but that's okay. We've had a shit ton of guitarists. We can get another one.
Mm.
He went to visit Phil when he got back, and Scott is now healthy, clean, sober, as he is today.
Yeah.
And he went to see Phil. He said to me, it was like I just left the room and came back 5 minutes later. Nothing had changed.
Mm.
And Phil said to him, let's get the band back together. And Scott said, Phil, I would love to get the band back together, but not until you get yourself sorted. And Phil, as always, was like, oh, that's what I'm going to do. I'm doing that now. I'm going to get myself sorted. We're going to reform the band. So it's a very sad story. But I personally will never forgive whoever's decision it was, Bob. I will never forgive them. I will never forgive them for not including Thin Lizzy in that show. That to me was a fucking terrible shit thing to do.
To finish up, you mentioned to me yesterday that on the 4th of January, Phil Lynott will be dead longer than he was alive. It'll be the 37th anniversary of his death, and he died at 36 in about 5 months, which is kind of... It takes you aback a bit when you read that. That's a life that's now shorter than the period that he's been dead.
Absolutely. I was 27 when Phil died. And it was really shocking because you'd see him around, you know, and I had seen him. He'd been on the show because he had that record at 19, just a few months before, and he'd been on the show, and he'd been sweating and overweight for a long time. He always had a cold, you know. But I didn't, the dying, no, I didn't see that coming at all. I was too young to have known many people that had died without being seriously ill with something. And also I was 27, so 36 was... it wasn't young to me. now it just seems incredibly young. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as you're old enough to die, but there is, I think, just too young. And he was too young. And I think
it's particularly jarring for me. I turned 37 last month. So both of those numbers are like relevant to my life.
So you're now older than Phil Lynott was when he died.
Yeah, so, and what have I done?
Well, no, I was thinking, you know, better keep looking over your shoulder, mate. That spectre could reach any of us at any time, you know.
I think I see a spectre in your house there, Mickey. You better keep an eye out as well.
No, that's the one in my eyes. So listen, before we go, Christmas, what are you doing?
Well, I'm finished work today. I will go and visit my parents for a couple of days. Elaine will be with me, so we'll do that, and we're just going to relax and do very little else between now and whenever I'm back to work, the 3rd of January, I think.
Yeah, possibly a small sherry at some point.
Maybe one or two.
Yeah. Well, don't small go sherry. Mad. Don't go mad, because we all know you get challenged in that area, you know, so be careful now.
Yes, very good. Well, we were
supposed to do this 3 days ago, okay? On Tuesday. Today is a Friday as we're doing this. We're meant to do it on Tuesday. I'm sat here like an Egypt. He's going red, look. I'm sat here like an Egypt, waiting for your host will let you in as soon as he remembers what fucking day it is. So time goes by. I message him. Right, I've got to go and do something else. Maybe we'll do this another time. A few hours later, I get a message going, oh, I'm so sorry. I thought it was Monday today. Another message. Yeah. I must have lost Monday. I'm going, are you all right, mate? I mean, and then finally he gets it together to sort out today. And he sends me a link for yesterday. So all I'm saying, Fergal, is whatever's going on, just remember Phil.
I didn't send you a link for yesterday.
You fucking did. On the Tuesday or the Wednesday when you finally woke up, you sent me a link and then you sent another one saying, oh, sorry, I made that for Thursday. I was meant to make
it. I sent you a link on the rearranged day, but I accidentally set it for that day. That's very easy to do in Zoom. It just defaults to that day itself. So,
and then you sent me the link two more times. I got two more of the same fucking link today. I didn't know which one to click.
You got there in the end, didn't you?
Now. Anyway, so.
Right.
Oh.
Well, I hope you have a miserable Christmas, because that's what you want.
I miss that. You hope I have a miserable Christmas?
Well, yeah, that's what I think you would enjoy, because you hate Christmas, so I hope it's adequately miserable.
Anyway, listen, you've been great company all year, and people don't understand what a great supporter and help you've been to me with the pod and many other things. And it was great to meet you and Elaine in Dublin a couple of months ago. We will definitely do that again. We'll just have to try and persuade the pub to unbar you, you know, because at the end of the night... They were like, get out to him, you know, and I had to apologise. So we'll fix that.
My mother used to say, I'm the type of person you can only take to a place twice, the second time to apologise. So that sounds about right.
I love it. Well done, my friend. Have a wonderful Christmas and to everybody out there.
All right. You too. I will chat to you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How do I stop this, Fern?